Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest exciting adventures from life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I'm not even going to talk about the political situation because I'm fed up to the back teeth, okay? And who knows?
Who isn't? I know.
Yeah, who knows? By the time our millions of listeners get to reading this, only the, get to listening to this, which will, you know, just be a matter of a couple of hours after we've recorded it, we might have yet another new Prime Minister. So we'll stay off that one. But I do want to celebrate with you the fantastic autumn weather. I was woken up last night. About 3:30 in the morning. I usually get up between about 4:30 and 5:30, but the rain was battering down on my Velux windows. The road was awash with water running down the hill where I live. The leaves were being blown off the trees and the trees were bending to the force of the gale. And it's what I call real autumn weather. And I got up as early as I could, even before light, and I went out in a pair of wellies to slosh around in the wet leaves. And it was wonderful.
You went out in just a pair of wellies?
No, not just a pair of wellies. I mean, obviously,
That is a thought for sore minds.
No.
If that's the expression. Well, Mike Parry trotting down the high street in just a pair of wellies.
No, don't put people off their breakfast, Miss Jones. the issue is that it's great to wear the wellies because then you can slosh around in the wet leaves. And then I headed on to the North Downs, you see, where they hold a lot of water in the soil and the ground there. But it was lovely autumn weather. I've been a bit frustrated the last few days because I thought, hang on, we're well into October and yet I haven't had to wear a coat. It's still been amazingly warm. So obviously climate change is with us. It's just a question of how you handle it individually.
Well, we've got to worry about it, haven't we? And I do have quite a lot of sympathy for these protesters, the eco-warriors, whatever you want to call them, in all their various factions. I do get what they're banging on about. And we have known about these things for 30 years. And our governments, successive governments, have not done enough to try and turn the tide, as it were.
I mean, to be honest, you're then getting into the, you know, the old debate about climate change. And I have lots of rows with people on the telly all the time. I'm not a climate change denier, but I do think that, you know, there are reasons why the climate is changing, which people don't address enough. But listen, Miss Jones, this is not a political podcast, so I'm going to get off that. And I'm going to ask you about your years on You Magazine. You Magazine, which comes out with the Mail on Sunday, every Sunday. And I read it, you read it. It's very much a women's magazine now, but it's celebrating, is it its 40th or 50th anniversary?
Yeah, 40th anniversary, Sunday just gone, yeah.
And of course, you were a prominent writer on that magazine in its early days, and you must have seen it change dramatically over the years.
It had been going 8 or 9 years when I was invited to join. So I'd been on the Daily Mail before that. Mm-hmm. I'd left the Daily Mail to have a baby, actually.
Right.
And the magazine was launched by a lovely man you'll remember called John Lees.
I remember him very well. Didn't he?
We worked with his son, Mike Lees, actually. Do you remember Mike?
Mike, where was that?
He was on the showbiz desk for a while, on the news desk at the Daily Mail.
Oh, okay. No, I don't. But John Lees, didn't he become the editor of the Evening Standard?
Yeah, he did.
I remember him from there.
Yeah. And then we had Eve Pollard. Well, they had. Yeah. I wasn't there yet. Eve Pollard was there for a year.
Yeah.
David English appointed her. And then she was offered the Sunday Mirror. So off she went.
By Captain Bob. Robert Maxwell. Yeah.
Yeah, so she went off. And they were trying to get rid of an associate editor at the Daily Mail called Nick Gordon.
Oh, yeah.
Who was a wonderful, maverick, mercurial man.
Well,
his politics were completely at odds with the Daily Mail and with David English.
Right.
And they clashed for years. Mm. But he was a very gifted newspaper man.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to fire him. They had no reason to fire him anyway. So they put him out to grass, as it were, at U Magazine.
Yeah.
And it might have been the biggest mistake they ever made because he turned it into this magnificent rival for the Sunday Times magazine,
right,
which in those days was, you know, a force to be reckoned with. It was stories all over the world, ordinary people doing extraordinary things, wildlife stories up against political stories, up against scandal and show business. It was the best of every kind of story.
Yeah, sure.
And of course, you have room to explore stories on a magazine because you can run pieces to 2,000 and 3,000 words.
And use great pictures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in colour. Mm. So Nick was now in his heyday, and the first thing he did was contact quite a number of writers who he had good relationships with and had worked with in the past, and he brought us all on board. So suddenly he had this dream team of writers with credentials who he could send out into the world. And he did this amazing thing. He raised our game. I was known as a showbiz and music writer, and I had made my name interviewing rock stars primarily. He sent me out into a war zone in Iraq. He sent me to North Dakota to interview a boy whose arms had been torn off in a threshing machine. He sent me into all kinds of situations where I had no track record at all, no contacts, and I had to work from the ground up. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Mm. And I wrote a Facebook post about this actually at the weekend, just to commemorate the 40th anniversary of you.
Yeah.
And the response was overwhelming. So many people got in touch,
lovely,
who we'd all worked together in the past, and saying, yes, Nick was highly underrated and he was the best editor they ever had. He gave us all a kick up the bum, basically, and turned us into better journalists. Mm. And Nick sadly died 6 years ago at the age of only 68.
Oh dear. Yeah.
And he was out of newspapers by then, but he would have made a comeback. Mm. He was the kind of person who would have gone underground for a few years and then he would have come back. Mm. And I still feel immensely sad when I think of Nick not being with us anymore, because I think he would come into his own now with the way newspapers have lost their power. Other forms of media have come to the fore. Mm-hmm. And I think he would have gone again.
Well, there you go. I read the piece by Eve Pollard, actually, in the commemorative edition. And she tells it like it was. Everybody's at each other's throat and everybody's battling to, you know, get to the top of the greasy pole and all that kind of stuff. She did incredibly well, of course, Eve. And I worked with her when, I worked for her husband, Sir Nicholas Lloyd. Nick Lloyd and Eve Pollard were the sort of star couple of Fleet Street. Nick was the editor of the Daily Express. Eve went on after the Sunday Mirror to become editor of the Sunday Express. And they worked one floor above each other. So they had a pretty good grip on the whole business, you know. But
well, I have a bit of gossip about that.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because I used to live in the same street as them in Islington.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Which was Barnsby Street. They're not there anymore, so I can say that. They had the big glamorous house in the corner that sort of took up two plots. And I had one of the terraced Georgian houses opposite.
Right.
And, we were not quite on sugar borrowing terms, if you know what I mean.
No.
But that was quite a fiery marriage.
Oh, you don't have to tell me. Each of them had a driver, right? Each of them had a chauffeur-driven Jaguar, so each had their own driver, and they had to spy on each other, right, and tell the respective boss, whether it was Nick or Eve, what was going on in the other camp and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I got on very well with a guy called Gary, actually, who was Nick's driver. And Nick used to tell me about the horrendous shouting matches and battles they'd have in the back seat of his car. You know what I mean? I remember once he said to me, and they were on call 24 hours a day, and he had to take them to some do in London. So I don't know where it was, say Park Lane or something like that. And 300 or 400 yards after they got in the car from home, Eve suddenly said, "We've got to go back." And, you know, they were already late. And Nick said, "What are we going to go back for? Don't turn around, Gary. Keep going." And Eve said, "No, Gary, stop. I'm ordering you. Turn around. We're going back." And Nick said, "What's the problem?" She said, "My dress is too tight." He said, "Well, why didn't you work that out before you, you know, left the house?" And oh, this terrible shouting match. And eventually, of course, Eve won out. They went back. And that was that. I've been in that house a few times, actually, because Nick had a 50th birthday party in the office when he was 50, obviously, and then a more private one with only a few, well, not a few, quite a lot of selected guests. And I was the news editor of the Express, so I got invited along. Beautiful house, most of the action, I think, went on in the basement, you know, like eating and all that kind of stuff. And I think it was 3 or 4 floors high. And the people he managed to get there included all the big advertising bosses, you know, and the PR bosses and all that kind of, and loads of politicians as well. On one occasion, Nick managed to get John Major to his house for dinner when John Major was the Prime Minister. And, of course, all the neighbours complained like mad. The road was closed off all day for security. There's a helicopter hovering overhead. Nobody was allowed in and out of, you know, the surrounding roads for 24 hours. But that's the sort of people they were, power brokers.
They absolutely were, yes. Yeah. But I remember a famous occasion. You might have even been there yourself. Yeah. We were all in the wine press. Do you remember that wine bar we used to get in on Fleet Street?
Loved it.
And Nick was in the corner, Sir Lick, as we called him. He was in the corner of the bar holding Sir Lick, Sir Lick Noid, he was known as.
Yeah.
And he's holding court at the bar at the back. And the doors fly open and in storms Eve.
Yes.
And she comes up and she pushes her way through all the reporters, all this sort of small fry.
Yeah.
And she stares at him in the face and she says, "May I remind you, you have a son called Oliver at home. I demand that you leave immediately." And he did.
Oh, yeah, he did. Oh, yeah, and I can well imagine that happening. I once had to take Oliver to Arsenal because he was the editor of the Sunday Mirror in those days and Nick was out of town. And she rang me up. She said, so she sent her driver, picked me up. Then I picked Oliver up. He was 10 at the time and took him to watch Arsenal. At half time, he wandered off and I lost him for about 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, talk about being terrified of having to ring up the Sunday Mirror and say, "Oh, Eve, I'm sorry, but I've lost your son."
Well, imagine doing that. Imagine putting you in charge of a 10-year-old, somebody who's never had children, don't really know how to look after one.
Yes, it's true.
You know, you just would not do that these days, would you?
Well, no, these days you wouldn't, but it was a different world. Now, Miss Jones, I'm very annoyed with somebody who's put a survey together. These people are called, who are they? A poll for skincare company Fenjal. And it's about the most momentous moment over the last 60 years. And they put in it the preacher Martin Luther King's 1963 speech, "I Have a Dream." Yeah, fair enough. The death of Elizabeth II only last month. Yes, fair enough. England winning the World Cup. Fair enough. And Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, all fair enough. What isn't in this greatest events calendar over the last 60 years is one mention of the Beatles, because, of course, the Beatles changed the world. They changed the history and the culture and the direction of the world in the second half of the 20th century. I mean, the day that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out in 1967, surely that should have been there, shouldn't it?
Of course it should, but they seem to have forgotten about all popular culture from the 60s, including the Beatles, the Stones, everybody else. I mean, you know, voting HMQ, the most iconic woman of the past 60 years, Diana, second, Mother Teresa, third, and the moon landing being the sort of statement event, the standout event of the century.
Yeah.
Have you ever used Fenjal, by the way?
No, I don't use skin stuff.
Well, it's not really skincare. When we were kids anyway, this was a sort of bath cream, bath sort of oily cream that you put in the bath water before you got in.
Yeah.
And it smelled funny. I didn't really like it. But we always preferred Badidas. Do you remember that?
Badidas. I think so. It was sort of more bubbly stuff.
Yeah, it was sort of in a chestnutty sort of scent and a very distinctive bottle. There was a TV ad. I remember it so clearly. And the punchline was, "Things happen after a Badidas bath."
It's rather provocative, isn't it?
Isn't it?
But anyway, there we are.
I used to say to my mum, "So what happens?" She would never tell me.
Well, it's one of those questions, isn't it? Talking about the newspaper world, of course, I read a piece by a lady called Kate Wills, and this was in one of the Sunday magazines, which I don't normally read. I think it's called Fabulous because it's a kind of woman's magazine, and you know.
Oh, it's the Sun on Sunday.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, that's. I just happened to, you know, just fell open as I was sort of pulling it out the paper or something like that, but. The headline here is Having a bully for a boss made me one too. And you know what? That used to happen in Fleet Street all the time. People who used to try and imitate the bullying boss and do it themselves. You must have come across loads of people like that.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's basic psychology, actually. This is just the same as children who are abused in their own childhood often, so often, grow up to become abusers themselves.
Yeah, that's...
It's one of the fundamentals of human behaviour.
That's so absolutely true, yeah. You know, I would see people who were fairly timid when it all started, and then the boss would be, you know, raging around, you know, effing this, effing that, dismissing people, being rude to people, humiliating people. And all of a sudden, you'd find somebody who fancied themselves, you know, to get up the old greasy pole of promotion, imitating this person, you know, imitating that, you know, loud, brash, bullying boss and taking on all the very unpleasant characteristics.
Of course, one of the things that it was in real detriment to was the cause of women in Fleet Street.
Yes.
Because you had women who were promoted beyond their capabilities sometimes, yeah, who were then marching about trying to be blokes. Mm. Do you remember a lady called Vicky Woods?
Vicky Woods rings a bell. What was she?
Very good journalist. Yeah. She was on the Telegraph at one point. She had a column with her daughter,
right.
Vicky and Octavia, sort of doing problems and stuff. But she was editor of one or two of the supplements at the Daily Mail. And she even wrote about this, that when she was promoted to editor of a supplement, she, looking back, she realised that the shoulder pads of her jackets were getting fatter and her lipstick was getting redder and her haircut was getting shorter. Mm. And in short, she was turning herself into a man to stand up to her bosses.
Golly, that's amazing, isn't it? The sort of psychology of it all and how you had to compete and all that kind of stuff. Talking about, again, you know, the workplace and all that. I read a piece the other day, Miss Jones, that, you know, we've lashed in the past about, oh, working from a pub and all that kind of stuff. But now, apparently, some pub chains are setting aside working areas for people who want to come there because of the energy crisis. People, instead of staying at home, if they work from home, can work from the pub and they get free coffee and, you know, they can buy sort of cut price lunches and they can use the Wi-Fi and all that kind of. It is, in fact, becoming a phenomenon. But what I would say, and we've reminded our millions of listeners of this before, is that you and I have been working out of pubs for like 30 years. We're working out of pubs, I mean, from the day we started in journalism, weren't we?
Of course, yeah, there was an adage too, wasn't there, that if you were in the office sitting at your desk, you weren't doing the job.
Exactly. You were sitting there and the editor would walk through and then say to the news editor, why are all those reporters sitting around doing nothing? In fact, you know, they might be researching something, going to the cut or something like that or whatever, or ready to go out on a job, but it didn't look good. So news editors I've worked for would always say, as soon as the pub's open, you know, F off to the pub and we know where you are and we'll give you a call when we've got to send you somewhere. But right from the early days as a reporter, for instance, you'd go out on a story and, you know, it'd be freezing cold in the north of England somewhere if I was working for the Express in, you know, like the Lake District or something like that. So when you'd got the story done and you'd seen all the people that you need to see, of course you headed for the pub, because in those days there weren't any mobile phones. So if you got to the pub, A, there was a telephone, B, it was warm and it wasn't raining, and C, of course, you were going to fill yourself up with drink to inspire your writing skills. And that's where you always headed on a job, wasn't it?
Oh, of course. And D, anybody might walk into the pub who might lead you onto another story.
Absolutely,
you
know, right.
All that.
Absolutely.
I tell you where I loved working the most when I was on my stint in New York. Yeah. You'd probably agree with this, having done it yourself.
Yeah.
But there was such a rich tapestry of brilliant pubs with great histories and traditions to go to. I'm thinking of places like the Bells of Hell on West 13th.
Bells of Hell go ding-a-ling-a-ling. That was run by Peter, wasn't it? Peter the Pine.
Yeah, Peter Myers. Yeah. But before that, by a guy called Malachi McCourt.
Oh, right.
Do you remember him?
I don't remember him, no.
He was the brother of Frank McCourt, who wrote famously Angela's Ashes.
Of course, I didn't realise that.
And they used to say of him, you could run a bar on candles and borrowed ice. And I think we're back there, aren't we?
Well,
but then there was, where else do we used to go? The White Horse Tavern on Hudson Street.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Down in the village, yeah.
Chumley's in the West Village, the Red Lion on Bleecker Street, wasn't it, in Greenwich Village?
Red Line in Bleecker Street, that's where Mickey, the very famous photographer,
Mickey Brennan.
Thank you very much, Mickey Brennan. Mickey Brennan would go there two or three times a week and I'd go down with him and wouldn't come out until 6 o'clock the next morning, you know. The Rook.
Oh, and it was all yellow inside, and they had that phone booth in the back there, didn't we? All were filing copy from the phone booth.
Absolutely. I mean, Eamon Durand's on Second Avenue, famous Irish bar, and Eamon was a great guy. And these were places that knew you so well because you hardly ever paid. You'd go in at the end of a week and they'd say, what is it? And they say $75 or something like that. You didn't have to worry about, paying for your drinks as you got them. It wasn't like you didn't hand money over every time you got a drink. You just paid your tab at the end of the week. And
they were fantastic days. Yeah. But, the Red Lion, which I was particularly fond of, I always used to go there. And then it closed down and it was closed for a really long time. Yeah. But it's reopened now. It's got live bands. It's got a dance floor. They show premiership matches because it's primarily expats, English people who go there.
Sure,
But it's not a journalist pub anymore. No. It's a great shame.
No, I mean, of course, the most famous one, which we used as the office, as everybody else, was, it's gone right over my head now, the famous bar on 44th Street, which I used all the time. It'll come back to me in a second. I used to live in there, once you'd finished work at 2 o'clock every day, straight round to Costello's. I'm sorry.
Oh, Costello's. Didn't we love it there?
Well, and Costello's, you're right. I had another phone booth. And the phone booth was like a spaceship. It was a big circular tube, like a huge sort of cigar tube, the sort of thing.
That's right. I remember. Yeah. I remember. And it was in the back on the left-hand side near the toilet.
That's right. And a window. So, like a window as though you're inside a spaceship. And so it was always very difficult to concentrate because people were always making rude gestures at you and that kind of stuff. And you're filing copy, you know what I mean?
Oh, those were the days.
Yeah, they certainly were. By the way, and I know we've spoken about this before, Miss Jones, and you've got a million tales about it, but Bill Wyman's 86 today. And you don't see much of him these days, do you? I mean, a lot of rock stars sort of still keep going well into that sort of age, but Bill Wyman's just faded away, hasn't he?
We've still got his band, the Rhythm Kings.
Wow.
People were posting pictures sort of heralding his birthday, and I looked and thought, yet again, I thought to myself, you should be inside.
Yeah, you keep saying that whenever we talk about him, indeed. Do you know, by the way, I've seen this report getting away now from Bill Wyman, 2 million people in this country have never seen the countryside to this day. I mean, 100 years ago, you just said, well, that's normal. There were no roads and all that kind of stuff. People sometimes were born and grew up in villages in Gloucestershire and never went out of them. But to this day, 2 million people, and mostly from places like Birmingham and, sort of inner city places like that, have never seen the countryside. Isn't that sad?
It seems far-fetched to me, that, because most people have watched television.
Yeah.
Most people will have watched things like, what's the vet series? They've revived it recently, remade.
Creatures Great and Small.
That, yeah. So most people will have seen fields. Mm. Most people have been on school trips and they go out to farms and things when they're at school. Most people will have been to Spain or to France or any of that. So they will have gone through countryside in a car or on a train or whatever. Yeah. So I find that very hard to believe. The other thing I always wonder when they do these surveys, who do they ask? Because never in my life have they ever asked me.
No, I agree. Yeah, I know. You're absolutely right. I had a very strange relationship with my grandparents in that I only ever met one of them, or two of them, I think. But yeah, I think I met both my grandmothers, but I never met my grandfathers, okay?
What, were they alive?
They were alive, yeah.
But you never met them?
I met my mother's mother once in the whole of my life, and I met my father's mother once in the whole of my life, and I never saw either of my grandfathers.
That's so strange.
Very strange, but you've got to remember it was post-war, and my mother had been bombed out of her home and had to live with her grandmother. And I think I've told people this before, there was a shocking history of alcoholism throughout our family. And their families were very divided and split up. But on the one occasion, I went to see my mother's mother, lived in Birkenhead. I mean, she hadn't moved out of the street she lived in all her life, literally. It was one of those. It was almost Victorian in the. And we only ever went there once, and I was appalled. It was, you know, without being hurtful to my family. It was a hovel in Birkenhead. And the reason we never went there was because of the terrible living standards and all that kind of stuff, you know. So as recently as the last generation for me, I can believe this happened. But I agree with you. It would be very strange if people hadn't seen a green field these days. And
do you know, I had 6 grandparents when I was a child. Because I had my mother's mother and father, yeah, and I had my father's father and mother, and we also had my father's grandparents still alive.
Really?
Nana and Grandad Powell, they were known as.
Amazing.
And there are pictures right up until I was 6 or 7 years old of them,
yeah,
two tiny little Welsh people.
Really?
You know, they came to live with my parents,
yeah,
shortly after my mum and dad got married, which wasn't great,
right,
for the beginning,
yeah,
of their,
right,
married life, but that's,
sure,
how things were back,
sure,
then.
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's, the fantastic shaving experience. Harry's are not just the super sharp razor company people, they are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for the delivery, okay? Now, in your trial pack, you get a unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge, complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade carrier, or cover, I should say, if you're on the move, right? Also, a hydrating night lotion spray as an extra special gift. Now, absolutely everything you need is there for the smoothest of shaves, okay? Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And believe me, you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink, okay? And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier and healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free, absolutely nothing to cause you any concern. Everything is crafted by experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. Let me give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having tuned in today to Life on Planet Porky, latest adventures from the kingdom that Miss Jones and I live in. I read a very moving story. Is it moving or fascinating story, Miss Jones, about the fashion queen, Karen Millen? I don't know if you saw it, but I know you do read the publications that I read this one in.
Yeah, I did read the interview with her, yes.
I mean, honestly, it rocked me to my boots, the way that a woman who had a £35 million fortune lived in a 6-bedroom house with a swimming pool and drove a £200,000 Bentley could have lost it all and worse.
Oh, yeah, it was very sad. I have history with Karen Millen.
Wow.
When she started out, she had a shop in Tunbridge Wells, her very first shop,
yeah,
just a little shop in the Pantiles.
Yeah.
And I lived in Sevenoaks at the time. And I remember very clearly going into that shop and buying a black velvet skirt.
Right.
And this is an amazing skirt because everybody in my family has worn this skirt, including my son, who once wore it scrunched up as a ruff in a play.
Really?
And I think it's still kicking around. I think my younger daughter's got it now.
Oh.
And she went from making her own clothes. I had a lovely, a beautiful cream silk ruffled shirt as well from her, which,
right,
I wore for years and years till it fell to bits. Just a lovely designer, very clear, sharp lines,
yep,
but with that sort of Elizabethan touch to them. And she went from strength to strength. Investors bought her out, but they kept her name. Yeah. She kept on designing. Yeah. But then something somewhere along the line, and this happens so often, creative people are not business people.
Not always. Sometimes they are. But, I think Simon Cowell is and people like that. But I accept what you're saying. You can make mistakes so easily.
See, Simon Cowell is more of a businessman than a creative.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think that when you sign an artist to his label that he's the guy behind the desk. He's not producing the record, you know. But I think Karen Millen fell foul of her lack of ability in the boardroom. Mm. She wasn't a businesswoman and she got taken for a ride and she lost everything. And she also had a very painful divorce and lost everything else. Yeah. I had a great night out with her once, her and Leslie Clark, she's divorced from Nikki Clark, who was the celebrity hairdresser. And we were all at the Mail on Sunday Features Christmas party, hanging around in the corner like silly little schoolgirls. Mm. I've got a picture of the three of us somewhere.
Wow.
And then we went out on the town and had the best night and vowed to keep in touch. But of course, you know, life gets in the way. And
was she the famous fashion designer then that she became?
Oh, she was out the other side of it. Oh. So this is relatively recently. It's only about 5 years ago.
I see, right. Anyway, the reason this story came up was because quite recently, both Liz Truss, who was then Prime Minister, so you know how recent that is, and Kate, Princess of Wales, both appeared at, high-quality events, high-profile events, and both wore Karen Millen dresses because, just for the benefit of our millions of listeners, although Karen Millen fell from grace and faced bankruptcy and £6 million bills for unpaid tax and all that, the label goes on. The label was bought by the same people who own Boohoo and all that kind of stuff, and they've kind of revived it. But, of course, she has no part now in the revival. Honestly, one of the saddest parts of this was how she fought through the courts to try and be able to use the initials KM. Even though she'd sold the rights to Karen Millen, she wanted to start a new label or a new range of goods with KM. The people who owned Karen Millen said, no, you can't because it's too close to your own name. She fought it through the courts and spent £3 million on legal costs. My God. How people can, get themselves into that situation.
Well, if you imagine, if you'd been in business and the name of your business was Mike Parry, and suddenly for all the reasons you couldn't pay your tax, whatever, but your company goes on with your name, how galling that is.
Exactly.
To have that Mike Parry business out there and you don't have a right to use your own name.
No, I totally agree. There was so much in this piece which resonated with me. I had a terrible tax problem the second time I came back from America. I hadn't bothered paying any tax while I was there. Not because I was trying to cheat the taxman, but I just didn't get myself organised, you know what I mean? And I thought, what does it matter? You know, they're sending me all this money. It's all piling up in the bank. When I go back, because I had plans to come back and restart in Fleet Street, I'll just transfer it back to England. I did all of that. And then about 18 months later, I got the most horrendous tax bill because of the difference in the exchange rates and it had all gone in favour of the Americans. I got a tax bill for about 100 grand. And I literally had to sell the flat I was living in at the time. So I know the horror of the tax bill and I know the horror of the mounting legal costs because I once took an employer to court for what I thought was unfair dismissal. And the cost just kept going up and up and up. And at one point I thought, I don't know how long this can go on. And then suddenly I won. But it was a terrifying, you couldn't go to sleep at night thinking of the cost, you know?
Oh, the worry of money. And of course, when you get into the tax what's the word I'm looking for? When you get into unpaid tax.
Yes, that's right,
People don't take into account the interest.
That's right. Absolutely.
And the interest is what kills you.
Absolutely. George Best had the same problem. I remember George Best telling me that it wasn't so much that he'd been landed with a huge tax bill, because George Best was completely disorganised. He didn't pay any tax on earnings for, doing adverts and all that kind of promotions and all that kind of stuff, you know. And he said it wasn't so much the tax bill. He could have found somebody to lend him it to pay that. I think it was about £80,000 in those days. It was the interest, which was putting up by about another 10% every month.
Oh, yeah. It's astonishing. That's what caused the downfall of Liz Jones as well.
Oh, was it? Was that what happened?
Well, she went bankrupt, and that was because she couldn't pay her tax.
Yeah, but that was Liz's fault. She was very highly paid, from what I can make out, but she made no provisions for tax whatsoever. And the strange thing is, she now lives quite a lavish lifestyle because she's still paid very well, but she's lost the ability now to raise the $200,000 or $300,000 you need these days to put down as a deposit to buy your own house.
Yeah, she lives in a rented property in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
But she had done things. She did live very grandly. She bought her sister a house for cash.
Yes.
And she had her wedding at Babington House, which is the country estate the Soho House Group.
Sure.
And she's a design nut. You know, everything had to be designer this, designer that.
Yeah.
And so she lived beyond her means. Mm. And she wasn't putting aside the tax provision.
That's right.
And it gets them all in the end.
Yeah, it does indeed. And she had the interest problem, did she? Every month another, it's like paying a mortgage every month on the original debt. Anyway, there we are. Now, Miss Jones, did you ever have anything to do with Blind Date? I'm not sure if it was your era or not, but the reason I ask is because I found out that 30 years ago this week, the only wedding that ever emerged from, you know, those hundreds of episodes of Blind Date took place today. I used to love Blind Date because I thought it was kind of, it was scintillating and flirtatious and provocative, but all good, clean fun, I thought.
It was fairly innocent, wasn't it? If you compare it to these shows that are on now, all the dating programs. There's one revolting one called Married at First Sight, which I watched with one of my daughters once, and I just could not believe. And there's Love Island, of course, which is completely sex-driven, isn't it?
Exactly.
I think the thing about Cilla, she sort of reinvented herself as the presenter of this great Saturday night primetime television program.
Yeah.
She wasn't going to be a singer anymore. She'd had a great career as a pop singer. But those days
came to an end. You are my night and day.
All of that. She's a middle-aged kind of mumsy figure by this time, isn't she?
Yeah.
Even though she had fantastic legs. Mm. She did have the best legs in showbiz, better than Angela Rippon.
Yes.
And she wore awful clothes, sort of, Debenham special, weren't they, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Just sort of horrible outfits in awful colours.
That's a terrible thing to say about a lass
from
Liverpool.
It's true. I'm sorry, but it's true. Somebody could have styled her, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But it was a charming show, and it was harmless, and people watched it in their millions.
They did. Her name, of course, originally was Priscilla White. And her father was a docker in Liverpool, and her agent said, no, White's no good, he's going to be black. So I remember all that. Did you ever interview Cilla Black?
Once.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
What was he like?
It was after her husband died, Bobby.
Oh,
she was charming, yeah. But they'd got together when, I think she was still a teenager when they met.
He worked in a bakery.
She was
a hat-check girl at the Cavern.
Well, she always denied that.
Well,
she denied that she was a hat-check
girl. Well, other people have told me that, you know, it was the case. Anyway, what I'm saying is she was on the Liverpool scene. She mixed with the Beatles and Brian Epstein got hold of her and all that kind of stuff.
And George Martin produced her famously,
and George,
of course.
George Martin.
But I interviewed her after Bobby died and she was heartbroken. And he was her world.
Yes.
He was her world.
Yes.
And he became her manager.
Mm.
And they had their children. They were a gorgeous little family.
Yes.
They were very, very happy together
for
his whole life.
Yes.
And she never got over losing him.
No, I totally agree. It hits her so badly. She said during the program they made on the three-parter that she was very cruel to Bobby because he was an aspiring singer as well. But she insisted that he didn't launch a career as a singer because it would have taken the focus off her. You know, she admitted that and said, yeah, it was quite cruel, she said. But, you know, we had a great life and I didn't want anything to sort of upset it. A friend of mine interviewed her and it was only a few years before she died. I think she fell over, didn't she, in Spain?
It's always a fall, isn't it? Yeah, she had a house in Spain and she had a fall there, never really recovered.
Right.
It happens so often. You've got to be careful on the stairs, Mike.
Oh, no, I totally agree. But anyway, she had an apartment in London near Westminster. I'm sure why it was near Westminster. It might have been on the river or something like that, you know. But anyway, this friend of mine went round. And surprisingly, there was nobody in the apartment except Cilla Black. So, you know, there wasn't an assistant, there wasn't a cleaning lady or or, you know, a publicity person or anything. And my friend rang the bell and she said, yeah, come up. And beautiful views of the river, by the way. And they just sat there all afternoon, and she reckons she must have got at least 4 or 5 bottles of champagne out of the fridge as they chatted. And she said she was just delightful. It was like talking to your friend from school, you know.
Oh, I would have been on my back after 4 or 5 yeah. bottles of champagne.
Yeah, well, you know, that's Scylla, girl from Liverpool and all that kind of stuff. So there you are. There's a bloke in New York called Eric Adams. He's the mayor, okay? And do you know what? He's thinking of issuing a law that on the subway, you know, the equivalent of our tube in London, you can no longer wear headphones and you can no longer present your phone, i.e. it's got to be kept in your bag or your pocket, because he wants travellers, you know, the strap hangers, as they call them in New York, as they hold on to straps on the subway trains, he wants them to be more vigilant against street crime. And he reckons that one of the reasons why it's become so out of control is that people are cut off from their surroundings, headphones, staring at their phone. They're not being socially vigilant, which you have to be in any society to keep it straight. I think that's a good line of thinking.
I could not agree more. I have so often seen, I nearly ran a lady over once by King's Cross Station.
Right.
Just was coming up the side road to turn onto Euston Road.
Yeah.
And she was walking along, staring at her phone. She got to the curb, didn't realise she got to the curb. So she tripped down the curb, yeah. fell in the road, and she's staring at her phone. And I almost ran her over.
Yes, I can imagine.
My son was mugged at a bus stop. Yeah. Somebody snatched his phone out of his hand. One of my daughters had her phone taken out of her bag because a guy saw her on it a couple of minutes earlier.
Right.
I think the headphones thing, it's a no-brainer.
Totally,
if you don't want to get killed,
yeah.
use your senses.
Exactly.
You've got to be so aware
yeah.
on busy streets where there's a lot of traffic.
Exactly, sensory perception. But, you know, if somebody's going to mug you and they're running towards you, you'd hear the footsteps, wouldn't you? Well, you won't if you've got your earphones in. I mean,
exactly.
I think that's a great idea. Adrian Childs, a colleague within our business, the broadcasting business, you know, he's got this new book out about how he's cut down on his drinking from 100 units a week to about 30 or something like that. And it's basically, it's the story of a reformed sort of, not alcoholic, but reformed, very heavy social drinker. But I'm reading it everywhere and getting a bit fed up of what I am taking to be lecture. I'm being lectured upon about how much I should drink.
It sounds to me as though he's still battling it. You know, there's a bit kind of the gent protests too much, you know.
Yes.
Don't you think he's got a face like a deflated toilet seat?
Well, I'm not going to say that about a colleague in the broadcasting world. And if he has, then you've got to admire him even more for the success he's had in life, because, you know, he did very, very well. He did the one show with Frank Lampard's wife, Christine Bleakley. And then he did, he became the ITV chair for their football coverage, all like that. He's done extremely well. And now his girlfriend, by the way, I discovered, is the woman who's the editor of The Guardian. I can't remember her name, but so he's done very well in life. And I think you being rude about his face is a bit harsh, Miss Jones.
No, I think maybe it's to do with the booze, is all I was saying.
Oh, so you mean? Well, I don't know. I've been quite a heavy social drinker in my life. My looks have survived, so.
Yes, they actually have. You're right. Yeah.
He's an interesting chap when you see him. He's very, you know, he doesn't come the old I'm a big star stuff and all that. We were in South Africa, and another mate of mine, Andy Townsend, also worked for ITV at the time, where Adrian Childs was working, and went round to see him. They were both staying in the same apartment in Cape Town, I think. And for some bizarre reason, nobody could find the bottle opener. And, of course, in South Africa, there's lots of wine, you know, because of Stellenbosch and all the wine fields. And we wanted to open a bottle of red, but couldn't find the bottle opener. I think they just moved into this apartment, you see what I mean? And we couldn't find it. So Adrian taught us this trick. You wrap a towel around the bottle of wine, and in particular, you cover the bottom of the bottle, okay? And then you tap it gently against the wall. And I mean very gently, you know, just like nudging it. And do you know what? The cork moved out of the bottle.
That's unreal.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't be able to do that now because virtually all wine that you buy nowadays has a screw.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Had it been, we always used to think, oh, well, it's okay. You don't need a corkscrew because we've got a screw top. And then you get one with a cork in it and you can't find your corkscrew, can you? Because you haven't used it.
Oh, it's life, isn't it? First world problems. But I got engaged in Stellenbosch, by the way.
Did you? I didn't know that.
I did in one of the vineyards there. Yeah. That was back in 1995.
Yeah. Wow, fantastic. Yeah. I love Stellenbosch because you can stand on a hill in Stellenbosch and look in every direction, 360 degrees, and all you can see are vineyards. It's the most beautiful part of the world, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah, it was a very romantic thing to do, what my ex-husband did.
Yeah. One of the few romantic things, I think.
Well,
now, Miss Jones, tell me, are you a rattling sort of pillbox? Because I've read a piece which says in this country we now spend £1.4 billion a year on vitamins. I don't mean tablets. I don't mean prescriptions. I mean just going into Boots and getting, you know, the multivits or vitamin D or vitamin this and all that. I mean, I try and stay away from them, but I have to take vitamin D because I'm almost anemic in the sense that I don't like going out in the sun. So I have to take vitamin D.
Well, I used to spend a fortune on supplements.
Yeah.
I took vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, magnesium. Mm. I was spending a lot of money per month.
Yeah.
And I read an article saying that I was probably wasting my money because most of these supplements are excreted in our pee, and most of them are not doing us any good at all. They're not being absorbed by the body.
Right.
So I thought, well, I'll do an experiment on myself. I'll stop taking them for 3 months and see if it makes any difference. Yeah. And it didn't.
Right.
So I abandoned them. I used up what I had and then I stopped buying any more. What I will say to you about vitamin D, you can't just go into a store and buy a bottle of vitamin D tablets and take those. There's something to do with the absorption that you've got to take vitamin K as well. Mm. I knew quite a lot about this. You need to have vitamin K is another kind of vitamin, which you need to take the vitamin K so that your body can absorb the vitamin D.
Oh.
But you can't just do this off the shelf. You've got to go and have a consultation with a nutritionist.
Well, hang on. I go into a chemist. I pick up tablets for my heart, okay, on a regular basis, every 3 months, right? And I've been taking them for years. But every time I do, I say, oh, and I'll need a couple of vitamin Ds, please. So the lady just gets them off the shelf for me and gives them to me, and I take them home, and I take them in addition to my other tablets, and I've been doing that for
years. You're taking them under false pretenses because your body won't be absorbing them.
Mm.
That's what I'm trying to say. You need to be taking vitamin K with those as well. But don't take my word for it. Have a consultation with somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Good idea. Otherwise, I could be doing myself in.
You might actually be doing harm taking those.
I'm afraid you've started to worry now here, Miss Jones. I'll have to have a think about that. Listen, last night I had a little Twitter exchange with Sheila Ferguson.
I saw it, you cheeky monkey.
Yeah, yes, this is the year of decision. Da, da,
da, da. Oh, that was your favourite one, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was the first one, I think, and it was the best. I was at the University of the Trent when that came out, and you used to, you know, get on the
great Philadelphia sound.
Oh,
wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, fantastic.
I tell you, the one I loved of theirs was Take Good Care of Yourself.
Take good care of yourself.
That's the one.
But the one that captured everybody, and couldn't believe it when, you know, I was working in Chester as a young reporter. We used to go to the King's Disco. A mate of mine who was as hard as nails suddenly came over all soppy and glassy-eyed when will I see you again? Da, 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 da. And he used to stare into his girlfriend's eyes, you know, sing it to her. Never seen anything so pathetic in my life.
Gee, I was interested to learn that Sheila Ferguson wasn't in the original lineup of the Three Degrees.
I didn't know that.
She came in later. And also there have been 16 different members of that trio.
Have they really?
Yes, they have. Yeah. And people, you know, one of the pub quiz questions, why don't you go and do the old pub quiz?
Yeah.
And one of the questions that often comes up is name the other Two Degrees. But of course, it's a completely erroneous question because there have been so many of them over the years.
Yeah.
It's currently Valerie Holiday, Freddie Poole and Helen Scott.
Wow.
Sheila Ferguson left in the 1986 to go solo.
Wow.
But she was Prince Charles's favourite. Yes, they met. She performed, actually, at his 30th birthday party. I bet she did. Yeah. And he was completely besotted by her.
Yeah.
And the rumours went around for years that they actually had a thing.
Mm.
Could never prove it. He obviously wouldn't talk about it.
And you're insinuating that they did, Miss Jones, which is a bit unkind, isn't it? Because neither...
Yeah, why is that unkind? You know, if they had a fling, why not? Yeah. He wasn't married at the time, neither was she. But she later on said, she would say this often in interviews, that he ruined her sex life. That was her actual quote, because men never wanted to date her because she was Prince Charles's favourite singer.
Yeah, well, you know, could well be true. I know what you mean. When I worked in Birmingham on the Evening Mail, Ron Atkinson, who was a very flamboyant manager, managed West Bromwich Albion, and they had three great black players, Cyril Regis, Brendan Batson, and I can't remember the third one. But they got the 3 Degrees to come along, right? And they did 3 Degrees versus 3 Degrees. And it was fantastic, you know, spread of pictures and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that's a good idea.
There we are. Right.
She's a nice woman, though. I've seen her on television. She did one of those, you know, the Real Exotic Marigold Hotel series.
Yes,
where they took actual sort of vintage celebrities into different travel situations and so
on.
And they had people like Wayne Sleep and... who was that? Britt Eklund, who used to be married to Rod Stewart and so on. Really interesting. Barbara Dixon was another one, the singer, because you really got to get inside those characters and to see them as they really are as people.
Yeah.
I think there's a fascinating fly on the wall series there.
I think you're right. Very nice person, Sheila Ferguson.
Very nice.
Had, you know. Right. Okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us here on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, it's always a pleasure to work with you and to say to our audience, we'll be back again. We'll be back with you again this time next week. It was a big circular tube, like a huge sort of cigar tube, you know, the sort of thing.
That's right, I remember. Yeah. I remember. And it was in the back on the left-hand side near the toilet.
That's right, and a window. So, you know, like a window as though you're inside a spaceship. And so it was always very difficult to concentrate because people were always making rude gestures at you and that kind of stuff. And you're filing copy, you know what I mean?
Oh, those were the days.
They certainly were.
Don't you think he's got a face like a deflated toilet seat?
Well, I'm not going to say that about a colleague in the broadcasting world. And if he has, then you've got to admire him even more for the success he's had in life because, you know, he did very, very well. He did the one show with Frank Lampard's wife, Christine Bleakley. And then he did... He became the ITV chair for their football coverage. He's done extremely well. And now his girlfriend, by the way, I discovered, is the woman who's the editor of The Guardian. I can't remember her name, but... So he's done very well in life, and I think you being rude about his face is a bit harsh, Miss Jones.
No, I think maybe it's to do with the booze, is all I was saying.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I don't know. I've been quite a heavy social drinker in my life. My looks have survived, so...
Yes, they actually have. You're right.
Now, Miss Jones, tell me, are you a rattling sort of pillbox?